Hey everyone, this is your host Steven, and you're listening to the Learn Swift podcast. Today's episode, I've got Sam Jarman. He is an iOS developer at the Bank of New Zealand. He has kind of an interesting background that he hasn't really done too much Swift, and he is just now kind of starting to take it seriously. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Awesome. So we kind of talked a little bit before the show, but tell everyone what you do currently, and because you have an online presence, you've got a blog and stuff like that, but yeah. let the listeners know who you are and like what your background is.
Cool. So I'm Sam. I live in Wellington, New Zealand, you know, where Lord of the Rings comes from. And yeah, so I'm an iOS developer at the Bank of New Zealand, BNZ, and this will be my first full-time job where we're using Swift in a production app. I've been doing iOS apps since about 2009 when I was in high school, and I had about 15 apps on the App Store before I left high school, and did a little bit of freelancing during university and did a little bit of iOS in my first part-time role. But then I went off to C#.NET land for a while, for about 2 years part-time and summers for internships. And then in my first full-time role, I did a little bit of iOS, but that quickly became sort of a Ruby on Rails, Ember.js, AWS full stack role. And that was quite enjoyable, but I've always had this kind of, you know, deep love for the iOS platform. So it's really good to be back on that. And it's really cool to be having a chance to see what's new in Swift. Having watched it from afar, gone through 1, 2, 3, and now in 4, it's good to get stuck in and learn what good Swift looks like, what idiomatic Swift looks like. And yeah, really enjoying that journey so far.
So I think you probably, I mean, I think a lot of people that have been in Swift from the beginning would probably say that there was a lot of growing pains with it. So you probably came in at a good one, because there were a few breaking changes, unfortunately, from 4.0 to 4.1, which kind of actually confused me a little bit, because that kind of breaks the semantic versioning guidelines.
But yeah, that's... Are they using semantic versioning for Swift?
Or? No, I don't think so. But like in my head,
right? I used to it. Yeah,
yeah.
We haven't done that Swift 4.1 migration just yet. But we're aware there's some could be some fun times. It might be a bit of a everyone in the boardroom for a couple of hours type thing. Yeah. Just, you know, one of these Swift migration parties you hear about. It might be something similar.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't really, there was only like one or two things that I came across, some uses of flat map that were different. And then that was about it for me. I saw some example code that it was a protocol extension, and the extending on collection. So I think, however, that they were doing it was deprecated in favor for the not even deprecated, just completely removed from support in favor of the conditional conformances.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I heard Swift 2-3 was probably the worst one in terms of syntax changes and naming.
Yeah, so yeah. I luckily came in just after Swift 3 was released, so I completely bypassed that. It was like hearing an old veteran talk about, you know, the war that you missed out on or something.
Exactly.
1,000-yard stares and like the grand renaming or whatever they called it.
Like, it's an interesting problem with any new language or any new technology, right? It's like, do you jump in day one? And then once everyone sort of gets there, you're the expert? Or do you wait for it to stabilize and protect your own sanity, and protect having to learn and learn again? And so when it's kind of in a stable state, like Swift 3 sort of was, do you then jump in? Like, it's what suits people better? Like, I noticed that people like Garrick, who jumped into Swift 1 straight away, and Erica Sadoon and all these other great people, you know, they now... the authority on Swift 1 because they've been there, or Swift, since they've been there since Swift 1. And so I could have done that, but at the same time, I didn't really want to have to learn something over and over again when I wasn't using it in my day job and I didn't really have that sort of time.
Yeah, no, I understand. I think about that every time that I see like a new cross-platform framework and everybody's like hailing it as like the one framework to kill native development or something like
that.
And I think like, I was like, even if it was, even if it will, like, you're going to be doing that for a very long time before it actually comes out, and it's going to be a completely different animal. Like, I mean, I see job postings for like React Native developers occasionally, like, and I would say it's become a little bit more frequent that I've noticed just in my area anyway, but it definitely is like trumped by, you know, most of the time it's native developers.
Yeah, native development. And even like I'm hearing murmurings of Flutter at the moment, which is, I think, Google's answer to React Native.
So I have heard a little bit about I've dabbled in Android, and I listen to one Android podcast just so I can keep you know, up to date just on what's going on in that wacky, crazy world over there. And they this one Android podcast that I listened to had a guy come on and talk about Flutter because he was super excited about Flutter. And essentially what it is, Flutter is like, it kind of acts like it uses Chrome, but it's like down to they pretty much stripped everything away off of it, and it just uses the Chrome core, and then they built on top of that. It's kind of like a Unity or like a Unity game engine, but for your regular apps.
Is it like Electron for mobile?
Not quite.
Like,
because Electron still isn't native. This is native. It is compiling to native code.
Right.
It was very interesting to hear about. I'm not quite excited about it yet because I've looked at Dart, and that's the language that they're writing in, and it just seems kind of like it's kind of looks like a little bit of Java. I'm not very like a bunch of new, like, you know, whenever you instantiate a new object, you have to type new and then yada yada, right, so on and so forth. You see a lot of nested like anonymous classes and stuff like that. And that was just from the example that I saw, but I was just like, you know, if it does come to a head and it's like everybody's demanding Flutter, sure, I'll change, but I don't see that being the case anytime soon.
Yeah, like, I think, while it's fun to jump into new technologies, you can get quite distracted as a professional with these sort of new technologies and get a little bit, I think they call them magpie developers. So like you fly towards the new shiny thing and you don't actually get any depth in anything. You don't really sort of progress yourself. But I said at the same time, like on the contrary, it is cool to see new technologies and see how they're solving the problems that we have. And, you know, can we bring that back to our home platform? And can we use these sorts of solutions to make our everyday a bit better? So I see that the pros and cons are there, but yeah, you can't learn everything. trying to keep on top of everything.
Right. Yeah. And I feel like this is what like front end web developers feel like, because every time, like, just since I've been like, I think React was just up and coming. Angular was popular. And then jQuery has been around for a long time. I don't really know a whole lot about front end web dev, but.
It's the wild west out of the other.
Yeah. Like you've got, I know that the three bigger, I know React is king now. Angular is around number two. And then Vue.js is kind of like coming up a strong third, but at the end of the day though, it's like, I look at that and I'm just like, like dealing with, like, you know, Apple comes out with new stuff, but it's not like you're having to, like, aside from Swift, it's not like you're having to like deal with this like every couple years, like framework fatigue, I think they call it.
Yeah, I think JavaScript at the moment, it's rapidly innovating at quite a pace, and it sort of started with, you know, the backbone Marionette.js thing, and then it went into Angular 1, and then Ember came out, then Angular 2 was a massive breaking change for Angular. And then React came out, which isn't like strictly a web like front end framework. It's more of like a rendering framework. People build on top of that, and then like Vue.js, and people are going back to like just jQuery now because they realize they don't need a front end framework to fade in a label. and then people are going just to pure like ES 2018. So yeah, like it goes in circles, and you see these sorts of patterns. Like what's happening now in JavaScript sort of happened, you know, in the 80s for like C++ and stuff like that. It's these sorts of same patterns come. People experiment, they go overboard, they pull it back a bit. And these sorts of natural waves happen, and it's quite cool to see. But yeah, as a person who doesn't do that much front-end programming, like I'll be first to break out jQuery until it gets harder. and then I'll look at something else from there. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with jQuery. Like, it's a simple solution to a simple set of problems. But if you need something a bit more gruntier, then yeah, look around. But this sort of thing I don't love about modern developers, especially online, is we talk a lot about solutions and not usually about the problems. Like, we like to say, oh, React is the best, you should use React. But it's like, no, actually, what's your problem? What does your team look like? What are their team skills look like? What sort of data are you displaying? How are you displaying it? It's like, these are, like, let's go back to the problem and then talk about the solution rather than asserting that the solution is the solution to all problems.
The old hammer and the nail.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
So I'm going to let's divert from the the web front end world.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay. Interesting discussion though, because I mean, we are seeing similar stuff, but this is just with cross platform stuff. So you said before you came on the show that you were writing your Swift like Objective-C.
Yeah.
And what kind of gave you was that something that you're just doing just based on habit? What kind of started to lead you in the direction of like, okay, maybe I should embrace the language a little bit more? Or was it more or less like, I need to get this done in Swift right now, and this is just the best way I know how to do it at the moment?
I think it was probably the latter, if I'm honest. I was working at a startup, and it was about kind of getting code out. I was writing some example code for our clients to use in their own apps. And so obviously with iOS example code at that particular time, it was like, okay, we need to put out Objective-C code for this particular thing, and we need to do a Swift version. So I was just like, I literally had the two side by side, and I was just looking at one screen and typing the same thing, same function names, same responding to delegates, same variable names, and literally just pretty much taking out semicolons and square brackets. you know, so, but yeah, I think the thing that I had that pivotal moment when I watched, before I started my new job, I had a bit of time off, and I watched, I don't know what year it was, but I think it was either 2016 or 2017, the WWDC video on Swift 3 API naming conventions. And it sort of talked about clear and concise and clarity at the point of use, or like readability at the point of use. And I sort of had my little aha moment there. I was like, okay, this is all about making it very clear and concise, but not overly verbose like Objective-C method names are, like table cell row index path, you know, these sorts of long ones.
Right. Yeah, I had actually seen it's like a parody post or whatever. It was like how Objective-C names read like children's poem, and it said, "Do you know the Muffin Man? The Muffin, like the parameter name was the Muffin Man, the type was the Muffin Man, and then it was a pointer for the Muffin Man." So,
yeah. to your child,
yeah,
that's brilliant. Yeah, I like this idea of like, let's use argument labels, because when I first saw argument labels, I was like, what is the point of an argument label and an argument name? Because, you know, like, you know, that's two names for the same variable. But yeah, it makes complete sense with that sort of API guidelines. And now when I write code, I'm like, oh, can this method name be smaller? Or could it, you know, in fact, I'm just looking at some Swift and I wrote the other day in my other monitor, and I can already see where I've violated this principle. I have a function called color with offset. And it could be color and then argument label with offset and then argument name offset. So that's funny. It's an aside. But yeah, that and also the other video on, I can't remember the name, but it was like, I think it was protocol-oriented programming, like one of the original Swift
WWDC. Yeah, I watched that one, yeah. Yeah.
The one I've watched like six times to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a mind meld for sure. Bit of a wonky brain after that one. But yeah, just this idea that, like, I think I particularly love extensions at the moment in Swift. Like, we've always had categories in Objective-C, but making a category was actually kind of labor intensive. Like, you had to create the header and the implementation files, and then you had to write your code and then import it to where you wanted that extension to be and then call it. And then more often than not, people just wrote helper methods in their controllers. And that made very untestable code, because you'd have to instantiate the controller, expose a private method, and then test it. Whereas now with extensions, you can just instantiate the object, test the the function and look and they assert the side effects you're looking for. So yeah, I'm very much pro extension now, and even using extensions that, well, instead of like an Objective-C, we'd use like PragmaMark. This part of the controller now is about, say, the table view delegate. You can say extension my controller UI table view delegate to sort of say, hey, this block of code is about is the bit of the controller that conforms to the table view delegate, and then you can move that extension anywhere you like into its own file. But you know, you can, it can be in the same file. But I like that sort of let's group functionality into very small units, and it's just giving me that good like Uncle Bob feeling of like, yes, small single responsibility functions and classes.
Right. yeah, I've been I don't remember when I when extensions finally clicked for me, especially coming from it at a completely beginner angle, right? I didn't even have I've dabbled in a little bit of Objective-C just so I could read it essentially. So I learned about categories and whatnot, and I saw, you know, exactly what you're talking about, having to do the imports and then the header file, the implementation file, and a lot more difficult, and not even difficult, just more time intensive, as you said, than to just write extension, the type name, and then do whatever you will with it. I use extensions all the time, even for some kind of like, there's like convenience initializers for using certain types, or you know, any kind of like a function that takes an any, maybe I'll make it like, maybe I'll do an extension on that type that has a function that uses the same signature, but then I put in my type in there. And then whenever I'm doing the any, I can just like force cast it
as that type. Yeah.
Yeah. Without having to feel like I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah. Oh, I love method overloading. It's like, so just put a context, like I started programming in Objective-C at age 16, 17, and Objective-C, apart from a little bit of C when I was much younger that I didn't really understand, Objective-C was, for all intents and purposes, my first programming language. So when I went to like C-sharp and I learned about method overloading or signature overloading, when you could have the same signature and different arguments and different types, I was like, oh, this is so much easier. Whereas in Objective-C, you have to go, you know, init with string or init with view or init with, you know, boolean or init with number, and kind of call it something different to signify that it takes something different. But you know, like the example that you gave is perfect, because it's like, yeah, like I want to let's say make a UI view, and now I can make a constructor that just gives me a red view. So you can like call the UI view, initialize it, set the background color to red, and now I have my red view, and now I can grab red views anywhere I want. And it's just so convenient and so reusable and so testable, because it's just one small thing. Like, call this and then check the background color's red. And I know that will work until that test fails. And it will work everywhere I want to use it. And it's so great.
Yeah. I think that's one thing, like I hear other people talk and you see it all the time, but like that's one thing that I don't really hear a whole lot of people talk about a whole lot is extensions. I mean, everybody, like, I would say that anybody that's been writing Swift for at least a short, you know, a few months or whatever is going to come across extensions and whatnot, like that are of types that they're not directly working with. Yeah. Like, you know, and I think they're one of the more powerful features of the language. And I think it's really, it's so nice to be able to essentially make an object that you actually have no real control over, customized without having to subclass, or like in the case of like Swift with a lot of the types being structs, like you can't subclass string.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to be able to just kind of do that without having that overhead of this long inheritance chain.
Yeah, for sure. And I do wonder though, like, for example, when I was learning Ruby and Ruby on Rails, sometimes I'd call methods on objects, and then I'd be like, cool, that's in the standard library for Ruby. And then I'd go to some pure Ruby and the method's just not there. And I'm like, oh, what's going on here? And I ask around the seniors I was working with, and they're like, oh, no, Active Support adds that. That's an extension that Rails brings to the language of Ruby. And it's like, oh, that's annoying. There's no way to really sort of know that without digging into it. And I wonder about, like, are we hurting people who are new to Foundation and new to like UIKit by making too many extensions? Are we confusing them about what's in the standard library versus what's in our own? Because at the point of use, there's no way really to tell that this is something that we've added versus this is something that Apple's provided.
Well, you could if you did inline documentation for your extension,
yep.
You could say custom implementation, something like that. Yep. And if it's, I guess it also depends on if it's, you know, like if it's with a company or if it's with a, like a library or framework that's that, you know, you're pulling in via CocoaPods that has a public extension that's being exposed outside of the API. So yeah, I guess it really, I think inline documentation would probably be the best fix for that. I think, like, you know, not part of the standard, you know, string implementation or something like that.
Yeah. Back in the olden days.
Why it's there.
Yeah. Back in the olden days, we, in Objective-C, we used to prefix our category methods. So for like a Learn Swift app, you'd have like alias underscore, you know, red background or red view. And that would be very clear that this came from that library.
Okay,
it wasn't part of UIView's standard API. And you see this a lot with like SD web image. So it's like SD underscore blah, 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 blah. Or like LMFI has similar stuff as well.
I use SD web image. It's been a while. I haven't, because I Kingfisher, I think it seems to be more popular in the Swift crowd now because it's a pure Swift implementation. But
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that a lot. And I when I first started learning, it seemed a lot of, you would see a lot of example stuff where people were doing prefixes like that.
Yeah.
So I had actually picked that up when I first started, not really knowing even where that prefix came from. Because the whole, because there's no modules or packages or anything.
Yeah.
Because you could have a namespace clash essentially.
Yeah, that was it. So yeah, we prefixed everything, class names and category names, to not clash with other classes and category names and stuff like that. So it's quite, you were usually quite safe if you were declaring a method on an object, because that would essentially namespace it within the object. But then since categories sort of exist everywhere, you'd have to put some sort of 2 or 3 letter prefix, usually 3 letters, to sort of stop clashes, which now that we're so like privileged and like spoiled essentially with Swift, going back to that sort of reasoning and being like, what, they made developers do what, is quite interesting.
Yeah, you know, I had when I dabbled in Objective-C, I was like, you know, maybe I'm gonna kind of go down this road a little bit to see, you know, just to get better at it, because there's a lot of companies around here that want you to, you know, be well versed in Objective-C. And then I'm like, I don't know, I think I'd be doing a disservice to myself essentially, because I've been so focused on Swift. If I'm gonna just essentially have to completely start, and there's just so many, it's such a different language.
Yeah.
That I'm essentially going to be starting over from scratch, and then essentially having to figure out like which of this is actually objective, like, you know, what's the Objective-C part, and like, because you can write inline C. I'm not super familiar with C, so like I would probably think like something like, you know, const char. I know that's a C type.
Yeah.
But if I, you know, only because I've looked at some C before, but you know, it going like, but any other type that's something similar to that, like I might think that's some kind of native Objective-C type. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, I think my advice would be to go try some more Objective-C. I think mainly for a historical context, like where have we come from and why did Apple invent Swift? What problems were they solving? I think it just gives you that more of a perspective as a developer, a bit more well-rounded, to be like, well, this is how it used to be, and I'm very glad that it's not like that anymore. And so, yeah, like you get to see the problems that like Objective-C had, like no optional types or no nullability annotations until recently, or, you know, everything's class, or like, you know, passing pointers around, or pointers to pointers, or pointers to pointers to pointers. And you sort of, you get into Swift, you're like, oh, that's much better.
Yeah. You know, actually, I wrote a Swift wrapper around a C++ library that had a C API, and I actually had to get into pointers in Swift, which was very, it wasn't unpleasant, but like I've never actually had to deal with anything outside of Arc.
Right.
And with working with C code, like you get no Arc support there. You are dealing with, you have to manage. Yeah. You have to manage memory yourself. And that was definitely a huge, I wouldn't say huge learning curve. I wrote the wrapper in about a couple weeks, and most of that was refactoring after I already did some stuff, but it was a cool lesson to learn because I actually understood pointers better. I always thought of them more like they were just a pure reference, but it's really literally just saying, I'm looking at this memory address and that's it.
Yeah.
I don't care what's here. Yeah. I don't care what's here, but this, I'm here. I'm parked at this address.
Yeah.
If something comes up, I'll tell you what it is. If there's nothing here, I'm nil or null or whatever you want to say. And then, if something else comes along, who cares? This is what's here.
That's right. Yeah, call me old fashioned, but yeah, I do like people who kind of get lower down and sort of see what's going on. I remember pre Arc days. Arc was released about 2 years into my journey with like the iOS CocoaTouch framework, and it was a game changer because I was sitting there looking at like retain cycles or looking at retain counts and like working them out on bits of paper as I was coding, and I was like, oh, this really sucks, and I was like, cool, and then like Arc came out, and I was like, okay, just set it to nil and it'll take care of it. And garbage collection's a thing now. And it was great. But I remember like doing C and having to do like malloc to like allocate the memory and free and to like free the memory. But yeah, the whole retain release stuff, that was fun times. But I'm glad I don't have to reason about it anymore. And I'm obviously more productive now without having to reason about it.
I'd like to take a second to tell everyone about this episode's sponsor, Lambda School. Lambda School is an online bootcamp that trains students in various software engineering disciplines at no upfront cost to the student. Instead of paying tuition, students enter an agreement to pay Lambda School a percentage of their income for 2 years, and only if their income is over $50,000 a year. In the event a student is unable to find a job after graduating, Lambda School never collects a penny. This incentivizes Lambda School to make sure you have the skills needed to land a high-paying job. Lambda School is offering a free 2-week iOS 101 course with absolutely no strings attached. There are 2 cohorts available starting June 11th and June 25th, operating on a Monday through Thursday schedule. Each day covers 1 hour of live instruction, 1 hour of practice problems with TAs available to answer any questions, and another hour of small group discussion around the problems. The cohort covers an introduction to Swift, the basics of Xcode and UIKit, and is a perfect way to see if Lambda School is the right fit for you. Listeners of the Learn Swift podcast can sign up for the free 2-week course at lambdaschool.com/learnswift. Thanks to Lambda School for sponsoring the show. So we talked about writing idiomatic Swift essentially like with APIs and what you like about the Swift language so far. What is something that you learned in Swift that if you had to go back and write Objective-C that you would just complain about every day?
Probably optionals. I think so. Like at my previous job, I worked on an SDK, and the SDK was an Objective-C SDK. And so I sort of tasked myself with, how do I make this API really friendly to our Swift consumers of the SDK? And so when I was learning about optionals, I was like, okay, Xcode 7.3, I think it was, introduced nullability annotations for methods. So you can say, hey, when you give me this thing, it could be null, or it has to be not null, it has to be like have a value. And then when I give you something back in the return value or an argument to a block, this may be null, or this will definitely not be null. And then they convert nicely into Swift land as optionals or non-optionals. But in Objective-C, those annotations aren't terribly enforcing. So you still can pass in stuff, and it will just break as you expect it to break. So I do miss that. I miss that sort of defensive programming style. Guard. I miss just the keyword. You can do guards, of course, with just if statements and an early return, but I do like the guard statement. And then pattern matching in the switch case break statements. I think it's pretty great. I think pattern matching's pretty powerful. It's something to get your head around, and it's annoying to have to, well, not so much for like pattern matching in Swift, but in languages like Elixir, it's slightly annoying to have to execute the code in your head just to understand which method is called. But you know, if you're reasoning about a switch case break statement in any language, or like an if else if statements in any language, you have to sort of know the variables to know where the flow will go. So that's not too bad. But yeah, I do like pattern matching, and I think we'll see more of it in Swift. It's quite cool.
Yeah, I've actually there was something that I was working on. I forget what I was doing, but I had two optional values, and you know, I was doing something like I didn't care about the value of the optional.
Right.
But I needed to do something whether one optional was like whether they're both nil, whether they both had values, and then, you know, one or the other having something. So I used the enum cases because I was sitting there thinking how to do it, and then I remembered like, oh, optionals are really just enums. So yeah. I was able to just pattern match using dot sum, dot none, dot yeah. sum, dot sum, dot, you know, and go on like that. And I was like, wow, that feels really good.
Yeah.
I didn't have to unwrap anything.
That realization that yes, it's just an enum, writing your own optional type is also pretty straightforward. So you can add like none, some, maybe. and go full Haskell on it. But yeah, I think I still enjoy Objective-C. I don't screw my face off it anymore. I don't generally screw my face off at many languages at all. I don't think it's right to be sort of elitist about certain languages over another. I don't like people bashing on PHP, for example, like it's just a language. It just solves a thing. There's no need to have it go at people who actually use it. So like I happily program in both, but I definitely agree that Swift is easier to read, sometimes easier to write, does put you in a good mindset for making small composable units, which lends itself very well to testing. And generally the syntax is a little bit more cleaner, which I do like as well. And not a square bracket in sight, which is quite lovely, except for lists where they should be.
Subscripting.
Yeah.
But I think that whenever I looked at Objective-C, and I never actually looked at Objective-C before I decided to start trying to, you know, program iOS applications, and that was that started in Swift. But whenever I did, I was like, I just like it just boggled my mind because I had dabbled in some stuff before, like Python and whatnot, but Objective-C just looks, it doesn't look like any other language that I've ever seen before.
It doesn't, does it?
So like I could not wrap my hand around all these brackets, all the, you know, and I never had really messed with C or C++ before either. So like I had no clue what all the asterisks were for the pointers, and it was just kind of I'm just gonna stick to Swift.
Yeah. I get that. Like, I guess from my angle, when Objective-C was my first programming language, going to the other languages, they look like little toys, little play languages. Because I went from Objective-C.
Look at your clean syntax. Yeah.
I went from like Objective-C to, when I went to university, they started us on Python. I still went through the Programming 101 type course. And so in Objective-C, you'd go like, you know, ns number star my number equals ns number number with int 5. All in square brackets, that big statement. And then in like Python, you just go a equals 5. And you're like,
right.
Is that it? Like, surely there's more. And I'm like, no, surely there's more. Like, that can't be, it can't be that easy. And people are like, no, it's that easy. I'm like, well, I can't it. I'll be done quicker than I thought. But yeah, you do definitely type a lot to say not much in Objective-C.
Yeah.
That's funny for me when I went to Ruby, where Ruby's all about how little can I type to say what I want to say. To the point where clarity does get lost, which is where Swift does better on that front. But yeah, in Ruby, it just looks like black magic, a series of commands sometimes. It's just like spells, you know, rather than actually programming.
Yeah, I have looked at Ruby code, and it's one of those things like where, especially where when it doesn't look like anything else that you've written in, it just looks like it's like, well, I have no clue what's going on here. I see a do, and yeah. I see
an end.
Yeah.
I see a death, that makes sense. Yeah. I see an if, but then sometimes I see an if end and like, what is, like, and I don't see any curly brackets. How are you actually doing anything? What's the scope?
Is white space in Ruby important like it is in Python?
I don't know in terms of like strict compilation, but it's important in terms of your happiness and the happiness of your fellow programmers, which is often more important than what the compiler thinks.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I know in Python, like you actually Python's have like
white space. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to have the white space for the compiler or interpreter, whatever it is. I don't
know. It's Python.
Is that interpreted? I don't even remember.
Yeah. It's just in time interpreted. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I like going to other languages, and then the more languages you do, the more times you'll come to a language. Like even you going to Objective-C, you're like, okay, well, there's an object, and this is a method, and there's these arguments. It looks bizarre, but I know the notion of object-oriented programming and sending, you know, arguments to a function and calling that on the object. So like, I know like what an if looks like and like a conditional. I know what a loop looks like and a while loop. Or what a function looks like. So you can still have these like mental models that sort of map to most procedural languages. It's when you go from like Swift to like Elixir or like Erlang or, you know, Prolog or Lisp, and it's like, what is going on?
Yeah.
I just want a variable, please.
And all the change of value operators and stuff.
Oh yeah. What are your thoughts on defining your own operators in Swift?
So the one that I am a relative fan of, and it seems to be relatively widely used for doing transformations, is the, like, I guess you could call it like the lift or the pipe in operator. It's the straight, like when, if you were to do a grep on the command line, the straight line up and down, and then right angle bracket. I've used that a handful of times when needing to transform an object to an object to an object to an object, where it just nesting it all inside of each other, essentially working backwards, just looked awful. And I think it should be used very lightly, and it should be like, if you're thinking, oh, I'm just going to make an operator, that's probably not the way to do it. If what you're doing would actually be more clear by defining a new operator, and it's worth somebody else having to go look at the implementation of that to understand like what exactly is it doing, but it reads much more clear. I think that's a time when it's okay to use an operator, a new operator.
It's definitely a heavy axe to swing, I think. You may get more clarity in just using a method that's well named. But yeah, once you start defining your own operators, and you look at any of the definitions of these operators, and it's always like type T and type U and T and all these like generic stuff, and you're just trying to sit there and figure out what's going on. Even like, I came across a simple one in an old code base I was looking at in my last job, and it was, do this thing if this thing is not nil. So like, it would unwrap the optional and then apply the function if it wasn't optional or had a value. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. But it was like two lines of implementation for the custom operator, but it took me potentially embarrassingly long amount of time to figure out what was actually going on here, because I was so new to Swift. If that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think depending on, I think any project that uses any kind of custom operator, there should be some kind of like
some good
onboarding in like the README or something like that. Hey, FYI, we've defined this operator. This is what it's used for. You can find the implementation details here, and this is why we use it. Just so you can kind of like wrap your head around why. Because if you just jump in and see it, and it's like, well, what the hell is that? Because it's almost the exact opposite of what Swift is actually attempting to do, in that it's not clear whenever you have a custom operator,
and it's
all the time.
It's a worry that I have when I'm writing code. It's like, is this code beginner friendly? Is it not only strictly beginner in terms of beginner to Swift or beginner to programming in general, but is it friendly to someone who's new to the project? Like at the bank, we're going through a fair bit of growth at the moment. We're hiring a fair few iOS developers. And all the code I'm writing is like, would this be easy to come and pick up to someone new? Because otherwise we're going to get growth pains, we're going to get scaling troubles and that sort of stuff. So it's like, and I love this phrase, clever code isn't, is something I strongly believe in. If I'm writing clever code, it's probably not that clever. It's not a good idea for the team. It's not a good idea in terms of software engineering to actually do that, even though I might feel really cold about this cool custom operator I've done in this cool one-liner, when really I've just caused a 20-minute headache for the next person who comes along.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I definitely prefer to follow the clarity over brevity.
Yeah, that's definitely a good way to approach it.
Yeah, that, yeah, it's definitely a, but yeah, I, the like I said, I use the pipe-in operator on occasion. I have a project that I made, but it's not part of the public API for that.
And I think I've seen it, and it seems to be becoming a bit more popular in a lot of blog posts and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I think it's widely used. I think it's used in like reactive Swift.
Right.
That I think it's in that library. And then I think it's borrowed from, I forget, a couple other functional languages that use it. It's not just something that somebody just decided to make up, and it's got its roots in something.
Yeah, being open source Swift as well, it might even find its way in the language one day if enough people like it. But yeah, and that's the cool thing about being open source too. It's like, if I find something I'm using a lot and I think that'd be a good addition to the language rather than just to my project, write a proposal, see what happens. I haven't written any proposals myself yet. I'm still trying to figure out what's missing. but yeah, I like this. I like reading them, and I like discussing them with my team. We sort of have a fortnightly, bi-weekly meeting about Swift proposals, just to sort of, as part of the meeting, we talk about Swift proposals. And it's interesting to see like the Toggle one that came up a couple of weeks ago.
I think Chris Eidhoff came out with that.
Yeah. It's just a simple addition. Like any method or programming thing, it could be used in the wrong way and it could be used in a very convenient way. But it's just interesting to see what people are thinking. Oh yeah, this could be in here.
I was kind of surprised about the amount of negative attention it got. It's like, you can just not use it. Like, it's not like,
exactly right.
You can, that's it. Or if you don't want people to toggle your bools, then make them constants.
Yeah,
or so, you know what?
It is a bit silly, isn't it? I can't really get behind being rude on the internet. Especially for people like us who we try to keep a bit of a profile online, you know, people remember our interactions, and if we're unpleasant, that says a lot. Seeing people in the Swift forums or on the mailing list kind of be unpleasant to each other, or unpleasant or snarky, it's not a great look. And even if you disagree, like, come at me with a logical argument. Don't come at me with a personal attack. You know, this Toggle proposal is not Chris Eidhoff. He is not his proposal. It is just an idea he had. It's something that every community has and every community needs to sort of solve. And every community will continue to have, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, I think the problem is a little bit worse than it actually, and I only say it because of this. When people are coming to a language, or they're wanting to try something new, and you have imposter syndrome, and you're not feeling like, you feel like you're dumb, and then you see somebody that's very prominent in the community has released books called Advanced Swift and Functional, you know, a whole host of books, and you know, Swift Talk series, and just a whole bunch of stuff, and then everybody's treating him like that. Like, how are they going to treat me when I say something that they think is stupid?
Yeah, you have to stick by your guns, eh? Like, you have to stick to the merit of the idea rather than the merit of you as a person, or your previous work. Yeah, it's a tricky one. I've met Chris. I met him in Australia at a conference a couple of years ago, and great guy. Really, really always keen for a chat and just really personable. I was a bit starstruck to start with, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I should talk to him. I had to chat to him eventually. We talked about woodworking. It was really cool. Yeah, they're just people. Like, no one is like better than another person. Like, having more Twitter followers, like having a bigger personal brand, isn't necessarily having better skills. There are some great Swift programmers out there who we don't know about. you know, like we all know about Chris Lattner and maybe the number two person in that team, but we don't know about the number 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'm sure they know more Swift than all of us. I'm sure they're excellent team members to have on any team. But yeah, it's interesting. Just going back to Toggle briefly, like I'm joking around with making a little library called Kiwi Swift. So New Zealanders are called Kiwi sometimes because of the bird we have here. And New Zealanders, we do a thing where we disagree with someone by saying, yeah, nah. It's like we go to say yes, and then actually we go, nah, like no. So we go, yeah, nah. So I think yeah, nah is a better implementation for Toggle. So I can go like my boolean.yeah, nah, and it will just toggle it. or like, you know, UIView.isRed. It's just like red, eh? It's like the question. I've seen something called Canadian Ruby, which has kind of inspired this project.
And okay.
Instead of ask like doing is something, you do is underscore EH question mark. Yeah, I think that'd be a bit of a laugh. I do like to make some funny projects to learn some regular stuff.
Actually talking, I had read something about New Zealand like having like essentially a drought of programmers and I don't know, it might have been tech. I forget. It was some article where they are having this big push to get people in tech to move out there so that they can, I think specifically in Wellington.
That was last year, I think. I'm struggling to remember the campaign name, but it was a big campaign to get people to move to Wellington, New Zealand, our capital city, and start a job in tech. Wellington has quite a lot of tech. It has a lot of government tech, being, you know, the capital. So a lot of government organizations like our equivalent to IRS and stuff like that are all here, and they're big tech companies essentially. It has a lot of banks. All of our major banks are here, and a lot of the digital stuff happens there. Xero and Trade Me are headquartered there. Microsoft has an office here. Even a bit of Apple out here in a battery sort of technology company. After a recent acquisition, so there's a lot of companies desperate for tech talent, and so the local council just thought, why not fly some people out and give them some interviews and see what happens. And I think the success of the project was unheard of. Like I think, you know, the Daily Mail and all those sort of really good Facebook viral news sites picked it up, and then they got thousands and thousands of applicants because, you know, New Zealand has a pretty good international brand, which I'm proud of. A lot of people came out, and it was really cool. I haven't met anyone who's been hired through it yet, but that's no indication of its success. So like everywhere, we're growing fast in tech, and Wellington in particular definitely punches above its capita size for tech. And it has this nickname, Silicon Valley. it's a bit cringe, but I'll take it. So it's a nice place to live. A lot of tech happening, but yeah. So New Zealand, believe it or not, in the middle of nowhere. A lot of people haven't been or think it's part of Australia. It's not. Just like Canada isn't part of America,
right? Yeah.
That would be insulting to suggest that as is our way. We're growing fast. It's one of our biggest exports behind dairy. And so if anyone's interested in moving to New Zealand, DM me and I'll do what I can. I'm a big fan of New Zealand and I'll be here for as long as I can think. And we're really punching above our weight on the global stage as well. It's really cool to be part of that, actually.
That's pretty cool. So there's one more thing I want to ask you about your recently getting into production Swift.
Yeah.
What is one thing in Swift that you, is there anything that you struggled with when you came over from Objective-C and, you know, Swift being syntactically pretty new and some different patterns that have emerged? Is there anything that you specifically like took a bit to kind of wrap your head around?
Yeah, I think some things I struggle with are like the guard syntax. So it seems to be like guard and then else return. So like if this guard is true, continue, else don't. And so when I wrote like unless statements in Ruby, I'd usually do the opposite. So I'd be like, look, unless these things are fine, please go away. Please like short circuit. So that was a sort of an interesting thing to wrap my head around. What else? Things like, where do I put extensions? In Objective-C, we'd always go UI color plus, you know, hex additions or something like that if you want to instantiate a color from a hex string. But where do I put my extension? Do I put it where I'm using it? Do I put it in a, you know, UI color plus my additions? Or do I put it in like a one big file where all my extensions go? Do I co-locate it with certain features? Like, where do I put them? And I haven't really got a clear answer on that yet. It seems to be a little bit heuristic at the moment, the answer. Because obviously, we don't want to get into this state where we've got the standard library and we've got all these additions, but it's very hard to find, without, you know, jump to definition, where these are all added in and if there's any clashes between them and that sort of stuff. So just, yeah, where you add that sort of stuff, it's quite interesting. But apart from that, it's been pretty straightforward, I think. Oh, no, there's another one. The one that I was Googling even just this morning because I'm still trying to get my head around it. No escaping versus escaping, or non-escaping versus escaping when you pass in a block.
So yeah,
does that matter and what does it do?
Yeah, I still don't know. I just know if it's, I know that if it's supposed to occur after the, after it returns,
then escaping.
It's escaping.
Yeah.
So it needs to happen synchronously. I think it's non-escaping.
Yeah. So I think if you have, yeah. So my current understanding is, and it's, someone's going to be yelling when they listen to this in their car, they'll be like yelling at the stereo, be like, you're wrong. But what I think is happening is if you pass in a block and the block gets used before the method returns, then that is non-escaping and the block is owned by the current run loop or their current function. So because blocks are objects, they need their own retain count. So you retain them for the use of that function, then you can release both the block and the function and you can bounce back up the call stack. Whereas I think if you want to use a non-escaping thing, so like go do this network request and then call this block when the network comes back. So you'd send off the network request, your method would return because like I've done my job, which is sending the network request, and then later the block gets called. Something needs to retain that block. So you might want a global variable or the thing that's calling it might want to own the block. And then in addition to that, if I want to use self for that, say like self reload table view, because the data's here, you need to use weak self because otherwise you have retain cycles and all this sort of stuff where you need to like understand multiple little concepts to piece them all together. And I haven't got all the little ones crystal clear in my head just yet where I can reason about them perfectly. And so talking about this sort of stuff is incredibly hard. And thinking about it quite hard. Yeah.
I can tell you one other thing that you're struggling with.
Go for it.
You're calling closures blocks.
Oh, yes. Not me. Objective-C. Why can't I call them blocks?
No. They act like the same thing. I just wanted to poke a little fun.
Educate me. Do we call them closures now in Swift? And is there any differences between a closure and a block?
Well, a closure is actually just a function period.
Right.
So there's different types, you know, you've got your different types of closures where you've got essentially like your named closures and then like which would be your standard functions with type signatures. And then I remember there being like three different ones. But usually when people refer to closures, they're referring to like essentially the anonymous function that you pass at like could be you can assign to a variable or you pass as like a completion handler.
Sounds a lot like a block, Steven.
Yeah, I know. But this is a Swift podcast, and I'm sure a lot of people don't know what a block is, so I wanted to just throw that out there.
Yeah, I think lambda functions are anonymous functions or closures. Yeah, I think they're all the same thing. I think they're handled in memory the same as well, which hopefully I'm not wrong with my previous statements about memory.
Yeah, are functions in Objective-C, are they reference types as well?
No, I don't think we talk about them like that at all. This is not something
I didn't think so.
But blocks definitely are objects. So
okay.
They have their own retain count.
Okay.
That's why I think closures in Swift are also objects. Well, yeah.
Definitely all functions are considered reference types in Swift.
Yeah. It's pretty cool to think about though.
That's still something that actually I get how, you know, I get it. like on a certain level, but then at another level, I just don't.
I think in my experience, you'll learn it when it's the cause of your problem. And it's
right,
like,
yeah.
Well, this is not working. Something's crashing and I have no idea why. Everything's populated with values. And then you're sitting there going, maybe it's something to do with retain count. And then you start this 3-hour Googling journey. And at the end of that, you're like, come up for air. And you're like, okay, this needs a week's help.
Yeah.
I remember doing something when I was writing. What was I writing? I think I was writing a Unity wrapper to the SDK at my old company. And I had to store all the blocks in top level scope in Objective-C so they wouldn't be released too early, because I was doing this exact same thing. They were escaping and they were being released too early, and then they weren't being called. And I was like, what is going on here? And I went down this big rabbit hole, and eventually I was like, okay, I needed to clear the blocks. And then I'm like, right, if you think Objective-C syntax is hard with square brackets, you just wait till you see the Objective-C block syntax. It is.
There's no, I've seen the website. I think it's called F in block syntax,
it sure is,
or something.
Bosh darn block syntax, I think, is the work safe one. But yeah, it's the URL is fair.
Yeah. Yeah, I've taken a look. I forget, I saw a link for it and I was like, oh, that's funny.
Yeah, that's very funny. I saw something similar the other day for Swift, but I can't remember what the syntax was.
I think it was like effing closure syntax.
I think it might have been something. Yeah.
But I think Swift closure syntax is a little bit easier to read than
block syntax.
Because I've come across and I was like, ugh. There's this the up arrow thing or whatever, the carrot. It's not a carrot. I don't know what you call it.
Yeah,
the up arrow. I was like, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, it's like it just says there's a block coming. That's pretty much it. It's really, but that's a weird thing to have. But I think
is it kind of like the asterisk for a pointer, but it's special for a block.
I'd not thought about it like that, but yes, that would probably be it. Yeah. That's okay. Thank you for helping me with that mental model. Yes, that would probably be it. Because it's usually like up arrow, shift 6 or whatever, and then open curly bracket, and then, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, more than likely. Yeah, makes sense. Okay. But I think, I think with the closure and lock thing, it's, as a person who kind of goes across many languages as much as I think it's easy to be like, okay, that thing's the same as this other thing I know. But usually the devil is in the details, right? It's usually like, what's actually different about these two things, and what traps could I fall into versus what extra things that could I do to make, better code, more performant code, more readable code, with the differences that is between closures and blocks, or, switch case break in Swift versus switch case break in Objective-C, or guard versus, unless in Ruby or something like that. It's interesting to be kind of a bit more of a polyglot and just sort of see what's different and what's similar, and dive deeper when it suits.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I've definitely had a few occasions where my mental model has been ported to something else, and then it just like ended up like being completely wrong.
Yeah.
That is the root cause of all bugs. Your mental model is probably wrong.
And then you have your reviewer, and then you ask some Swift expert or some iOS expert or some native that particular language expert, and you're like, they look at you and they're like, why would you think that? It's like, well, because my other language does it like that. And you're like, they're like just nodding, going, no. So you have a fun time looking like an idiot, but you just own it and be like, well, this is how I think. Brilliant.
Well, Sam, we're kind of coming up at the end mark. Is there anything that you want to discuss before we sign off?
No, that's it. We've had a great chat, I think. It's interesting to be new to Swift after so long with Objective-C and Foundation. Sort of the foundation types aren't confusing me, and I sort of know the UI kit quite well. That'll get messed up at WWDC if they release this Marzipan thing, and I have to learn a whole new UI layout framework.
But
it's nice just to be able to focus on the syntax, the language, and doing it the idiomatic way, because I do want to write idiomatic Swift. It helps the team, it helps new people, it helps me, but it's all about making it a pleasant developer experience for other developers on my team, and taking my own self out of the equation, really. So I'm having fun with the journey, and I might even be back in a few years to tell you how it went.
Well, hey, if anybody wants to get a hold of you or check out your stuff on the web, where can they find you?
This place is at Sam Jarman, so SamJarman on Twitter, or samjarman.co.nz, which is New Zealand.
Right. And I want to remind everybody that the Learn Swift podcast is part of the Swift Coders Network of podcasts. We've got Fireside Swift with Zach and Steve. We've got Swiftcraft with E-Man, who I had on the last show, and of course Swift Coders, the namesake of the entire network. Make sure you guys check all of them out if you haven't done so already. You can find me on Twitter at Steven_0351. The show has a Twitter account at LearnSwift_FM, and you can always check out the LearnSwift.fireside.fm website if you want to be on the show and fill out an application there. Sam, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.